Welcome to The Sound of Economics. My name is Guntram Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel, and it's my pleasure to host in today's director's cut my deputy colleague Maria de Merzes.
Hello, Guntram.
And Gregory Kleis, a fellow here at Bruegel, focusing on many things, but also on monetary economics.
Hello, Guntram. Hello, Maria.
Well, Christine Lagarde will be the next president of the European Central Bank. She was nominated by the European Council this week, and she has a tenure of 8 years ahead of herself. A lot of things that can happen in these upcoming 8 years. And so we at Bruegel, we've been thinking about what should be her priorities when she comes into office. And two of the three authors of our paper that was published today are here present. So Maria and Gregory, the third author is Francesco Papadia, who's on holidays right now. And we miss him here for this conversation, but we've thought about what should be really her priorities going forward. And so what I thought we would do is we would first talk a bit about some key messages from your paper, but then I think also have a bit of a conversation about the recent fall in the yields. Both the Italians, but more broadly, also yields in Germany and France have been falling. What is behind it? Is it already the result of Mario Draghi's and Benoît Cœuré's recent very dovish remarks, including the one in Sintra, or is it driven by something else? And you know, what does it mean for monetary policy going forward? I think that's certainly one of the most immediate issues that's going to be on Christine Lagarde's plate. But perhaps let's start with a paper. I mean, you call the paper "Managing Uncertainty." Preparing for uncertainty. So, Maria, you like very much the term uncertainty. So why don't you start kick us off and explain to us what you mean and what you think is the key message of your paper?
Yeah, thank you, Guntram. Maybe I'll say a few words and then Gregory can take over. I think in the paper, and in fact in the way that we started working on this issue, we looked back and took stock of where the past 10 years have actually brought us. And I think if I could summarize where we are right now, and as a result of policies that have been tacked during crisis and beyond, architectural changes in Europe, I think what we observe is that really the ECB has done a lot to try and stimulate demand, but also actually keep the euro area together in times when there were severe risks that the euro area might break up. The ECB really took a step forward and took bold measures to try and preserve the euro together. In the famous speech by President Draghi, he really did, and his team, they really did do whatever it had to be done. So I think that's the first observation, is that the ECB had done a lot, and that had the result that it brought it in a position where it has got a beginning of a new era with a new president, which is faced with a very big balance sheet, something that we didn't have in the previous, pre-crisis years. We didn't have a big balance sheet at the ECB. And at the same time, we have very little room, very little space for what we call the traditional tools, let's say the interest rate being the most important one, to actually do more. So if we were to enter in a new recession, you will have an ECB that is actually both overextended in terms of its balance sheet, but also has less space to operate on the interest rate.
But why do you say overexpanded? I mean, so I think what you just described is basically what any central bank around the world has been doing. It's been particularly difficult for the European Central Bank to do this because of our incomplete setup, and it's very difficult for the ECB to organize the bond purchases of a safe asset that is basically a national asset. And so this has brought a lot of trouble, and certainly is one of the key issues going forward. I mean, how can you continue or reignite a new bond purchase program, how would you do that? How would you deal with the self-imposed imposed limits? The ECJ has given quite some leeway. I mean, doesn't limit legally the increase of those purchases, but clearly there are political limits. Perhaps you can talk us a bit about about how do we deal with the question of how to increase QE if that was the decision that is taken for a continued period of time. How will the new ECB president be able to do this in the end? I mean, I think it's one of the key questions, right?
Yeah, I'm sure Gregor will have very clear messages when it comes to this issue. But if I may go a step back, we are now you smooth the transition into the challenges now.
Right.
I mean, you're quite right. It's not just the ECB who is in this position. There's other central banks around the world as a result of having to react to the crisis that have overstretched themselves. The overstretching part is particularly important in Europe because of the particular setup. And that brings me to challenge number one. Challenge number one for the new president is that they still have to operate in what we call an incomplete union. That makes the governance of the ECB decisions that in a sovereign state are easier to take when it comes to the EU setup, the euro area setup rather, are a lot more difficult to take. And here, you know, the ECB needs to sort of tread very carefully between maintaining an independent position, which is a very good thing and very well exercised and very well researched theme in the context of running monetary policy, but at the same time, it needs to have the opportunity to contribute to a political discussion when they operate on issues that are actually even existential, like we've seen in the euro area. So that is actually challenge number one. There are two more challenges, and then I'll let Gregory come into the conversation. The second challenge is the fact that the tools are very constrained, and we need to think about innovative ways of managing the next cycle.
Right.
And there we do have a number of suggestions in the paper. And then the last challenge, and you're quite right, this is my favorite one, has to do with the fact that we are operating in a system that is governed by uncertainty more than otherwise. Now, why do I say that? The fundamentals of what drives economic growth are very different now and actually less known than they were, let's say, in the Great Moderation. We are faced with a digital revolution. That digital transformation implies that we don't know how it will play out in the economy. And we're also faced with trade wars, which basically run the risk of reversing the process of globalization. These are crucial for the development of the economy, and therefore they're going to be crucial in terms of how to manage policy in the context of monetary policy.
Well, Gregory, turning to you, so yields are very low in the Eurozone. The projections of the yields are also, I think you have a fascinating chart in this paper, which basically suggests that yields are going to be low for not just the next 5 years or the next 7 years, they are going to be low for basically the next, well, even up to 2049, they're going to be below around 1% roughly. So very low yields. We have quite low inflation. In a sense, you can say perhaps the ECB has already lost the expectation game. Inflation rates are now for several years well below the 2% target. Perhaps even inflation expectations become de-anchored. So the new president coming in, what should Christine Lagarde do?
No, that's a good question, and that's exactly what we show in that paper. We have only two charts in the paper, and the two charts are concerning expectation about interest rate, about the year-on-year, and expectation about inflation, and both are very, very low. So this means that basically, in terms of tool, it means that if the neutral rate, it means that basically the neutral rate will be low and interest rate will stay low for a long time. So it will be.
So explain what is the neutral rate, because I'm not sure everybody knows this.
But it's the rate that would prevail without a central bank, basically.
So the rate where savings and investment match
exactly.
And clear. Basically.
So it would be the equilibrium rate, where saving and investment would match if you didn't have a central bank.
And so it's low because there's a lot of saving and very little investment,
exactly,
basically.
Exactly. That's a nice way to explain it, yeah. So because this neutral rate, this equilibrium rate is very low, it means that that interest rate should be low for a long time. So this is will represent a very big challenge for Christine Lagarde because basically she will not be able to use the main tool of central banks, the tools that have been used in the last 20 years, which which is interest rate. It was really easy before the crisis to do monetary policy. You could, when you had a recession or a low inflation, you would cut rate. When you had a boom and you would increase rate. It was pretty simple.
Are you sure that the neutral rate is really so low? Or because, I mean, the alternative interpretation that is being advanced is that the interest rates are so low because the central banks around the world have been flooding the markets with liquidity. And that's the reason why, in the end, the rates are so low, and also why the expectations are so low. So the only solution to this is actually a more hawkish ECB and a more hawkish Fed.
That's a good question, and actually we discuss it in the paper. We say that, okay, most mainstream economists consider that the neutral rate is low. However, it's true that the estimates of these neutral rates are very imprecise. So it's true that it shouldn't be the only guide of monetary policy. And that's why actually we don't show a neutral rate estimate in our paper. We only use market expectations. And we say, okay, market expectations are low. So we don't take a stance on the neutral rate itself. What we say is that we don't know about the neutral rate exactly where it is. And Christine Lagarde, actually, when her team will tell her about the neutral rate, she should have a critical view about this. But what market believe, at least, is that the interest rate will be low. So that's why we think it's still a very important challenge. And therefore, it will be very difficult to cut rates if needed in the next few years. So the ECB and Christine Lagarde basically will have to use other tools. And that's where we discuss another important tool. And I come back here to your first question about QE. And what should the ECB do about that? Because it's true that when the ECB decided to stop QE at the end of 2018, it was also in part because the ECB had reached its self-imposed limit on QE, that they already owned 33% of the bonds from Germany, 33% of the bond from the Netherlands, and they could not go above that because they had decided to put this limit on themselves. So now, if they want to restart QE, and they might need to restart QE soon, they will have to deal with that problem. So they will have to relax that limit. As you were saying, we talk about the ECJ ruling in the paper, and I agree with you, and we agree with you that the ruling is quite lax, and basically say that there needs to be some kind of limit. So the ECB could not own all the bonds that are issued by governments. However, the limit could be higher. And so that's actually one of the recommendations that we make later in the paper, is that we think that this limit should be relaxed, at least for those countries, for Germany and the Netherlands, that are very safe countries that have both triple A. My France doesn't have a triple A, and we are not near the 33% limit for France. So we don't even need that for the moment. There are different ways to do it, but I think the first way to do it would be either to increase the limit for everyone, or at least to increase the limit for very safe countries.
So let's talk a bit about the falling yields that we've been seeing in the last 24 hours, which is really an amazing drop in the yields, quite comparable to, I saw a chart quite comparable to what happened after whatever it takes, the statement by Mario Draghi. So some commentators already basically say this is all down to Christine Lagarde having been nominated. It's in the last 24 hours. Markets think now that not only is she a dove, but she's also someone who will be very ready to buy government bonds across the Eurozone in a large scale. So we are basically here now in the business of making national sovereign bonds safe by putting them all in the ECB balance sheet. So we are celebrating, investors are celebrating that the ECB is going to buy up all the sovereign bonds. This is big headline in several of the newspapers of the country I know best, so of Germany. What's your response? I mean, is that a plausible interpretation?
I think we need to be careful with sort of concluding, drawing these sharp conclusions in one day. Yeah? I mean, with the news that Ms. Lagarde will become the new president, it's very new. It could all be noise. Statistically speaking, you know, you can't really conclude anything from that. And I think I would be careful not to. Now, having that said, I mean, we do have indications that policy will remain, we will try and actually fulfill its mandate, if I may say. So we try and bring expectations back up, try and bring inflation back to the 2%. So there have been indications coming both from the current ECB leadership that policy needs to be continue to be expansive in order to try and fulfill the mandate. So that's one set of news that would go in that direction, in the direction of the yield changes that we've seen. And the other news, of course, is that we're having a new president that is, from the little experience in her monetary policy statements, because she hasn't really made any monetary policy statements, but from the few things that she has said in the context of her being the top of the IMF, they go in the direction that indeed there's more to be done and needs to be done. So I think the markets, if you take both of these, the markets are sort of, you know, more confident that monetary policy is going to continue to be of the expansive side. Now, that, you know, we still only have very little information on this, and whether the reduction in the yields that we observe right now is just a blip in the data, or is a continued, and therefore a proper interpretation would be what you just described, is just too premature.
No, I agree with Maria, and I also maybe, yeah, we saw an acceleration yesterday, but it seems that the move in the fall in the yield already started after Sintra, when Draghi hinted at more expansionary policy. Also Curé made a speech that was also hinted more dovish, let's say. So it might be a bit like Lagarde, but it's also the current leadership of the ECB. And coming back actually to Lagarde, it's true that we don't know much about this. I took a look at, actually at all her speeches that were mentioning the ECB or monetary policy while she was director of the IMF. And it's true that she seems to represent quite a continuity with Draghi, in the sense that all her interventions were always supportive of what Draghi was doing. I found, for instance, a speech that was done in September 2012, just after OMT was formalized, and she was saying that this was a good thing. So, for instance, that's a reassuring thing for markets that Lagarde, from the beginning, was supportive of OMT, and I really think that OMT is a crucial tool of the ECB, and so she's supportive of that. In 2015, after QE was launched, she was also supporting Draghi and the Governing Council and the ECB. So it seems that basically, yes, she represents continuity. So I think that might have some influence on the current fall in yields.
If I may add to that, and actually if I may even depart a little bit from that, I think there is an element of continuity here, at the same time, what we do say in the paper is that this is perhaps a good time as the change of leadership comes in, but also actually about, if I'm correct, Gregory, about two-thirds of the governing council actually will change by the end of next year. This is a good time, since there's fresh faces coming into the ECB, to actually take a step back and reflect on what we've learned in the past 10 years or so. Is the monetary framework that we have put in place since the beginning of the ECB fit for purpose, given all the things, what we've learned from the crisis, the tools that are limited and different? What is the next monetary policy framework for the future to deal with the uncertainties? And I'll let Gregory elaborate on this issue, but the one thing I would like to say is that the conversation amongst the specialists on monetary policy go in the direction of understanding that policy on the monetary policy side can't really rely so much as it did in the past on what we call the baseline scenario. So policy, we identify what we think will happen, and then we design policy to handle that. They think that this is too limiting in a world which is governed by uncertainty. And there, I think we need to think of innovative ways of designing policy that is not based on the baseline scenario.
Well, I mean, let's dwell a little bit on this point, perhaps as a last point, which is really about the strategy, right? And Olli Rehn has been pushing very much so the governor of the Finnish Central Bank has been pushing very much for a revisiting of the ECB's strategy, monetary policy strategy, which hasn't really been done for some time. It has evolved, of course, very significantly under Mario Draghi, but I think probably officially we still have the two-pillar strategy, and we still have sort of quite a lot of strategy elements that were put in place more than 10 years ago. The Fed, I think, is revisiting. The Central Bank of Canada is revisiting its monetary policy framework. The ECB hasn't started officially the process, and indeed, I think it might be a good moment to do this and review all the various elements. And perhaps we can just talk a bit about what are the other elements. One element, as you said, Maria, is how to deal with uncertainty, meaning you don't just focus on the baseline. You also have to be prepared, of course, for various alternative scenarios, which are all possible. So that's one dimension. Now then, Grigori, what are the other topics? I mean, that we should consider.
Yeah, we say that there should be a general review of the framework and also of the toolbox. The toolbox, as we were saying, because some new tools might be necessary in the next future. But we also mentioned the framework itself, because it's true that it was not reviewed since 2003. There was an audit of the framework in 2003. That's when the definition became a bit more precise. But we still, for instance, think that this definition is still problematic, is still a bit vague. It's true that some members of the executive board, Draghi, etc., on their personal capacities, have mentioned that the target, for instance, is symmetric. But still, the target itself, the way it's defined, doesn't look very symmetric to me. And the markets sometimes are questioning that. And we see that
the markets are confused. The Anglo-Saxon press in particular is confused about it. I think it's when you read the underlying documents, I think it's actually quite clear that it's symmetric around the band of 1.7 to 1.9, and that has been repeatedly stated. Mario Draghi has reinforced the message again, and several members of the executive board have reinforced it. But indeed, especially American, I think, audiences find it very difficult to understand what it means, less than 2%. But anyway, I mean, I think it's good to clarify this.
Exactly.
Sure.
So that's a recommendation that we make in the paper. So instead of having this weird target compared to other central bank, why not just choose a simple one, which is targeting 2%?
Sure.
Yeah, I think the point here is that if you believe, like I do, that there is huge uncertainties around here, policy certainty is going to be a good way of counteracting that. But I think if I may add, the big question, I think, for the new leadership of the ECB is going to be how to deal with financial imbalances. And we have actually gone a bit full circle in this context. We started with a two-pillar system. We deliberately removed, at least in notionally, the relevance of the monetary pillar from the ECB. We didn't think it was relevant. We didn't see the inflation numbers back in the 2000s. After that, we saw that, you know, even if they didn't manifest themselves in inflation, financial imbalances, money growth, credit growth, these matter. And therefore, now we are struggling with how we're going to sort of deal with them in a formal setup. We have a lot more tools now, with the macroprudential tools in particular being a lot more studied than they were back then. But the fact remains that we don't have a clear framework for thinking of how we can react to financial imbalances, either in the context of monetary policy or a more broader context of financial stability.
And can I push you a little bit on this point? I mean, so do we actually measure inflation rate properly? Because we don't include housing very much in the inflation basket, and a lot of people actually argue that the main financial imbalances we are seeing now as a result of the very expansionary monetary policy are housing bubbles, increases in house prices that are not only very bad for citizens that want to live in cities, basically for poor citizens, so a real cause of inequality, but that are also problematic because at some stage they deflate, and we know that housing bubbles that deflate typically leave very big scars in the financial system and in the economy at large. So we clearly have a risk here, and I think it's a sort of a risk that monetary policy, while on the one hand being expansionary to bring up the CPI, the consumer price index, is actually all channeled in the end into the housing price inflation, while consumer prices continue to be low. And so that adds another monetary stimulus. And in the end, we only create a bubble, and that bubble will unwind. And so how do we deal with this? I mean, are we still in the right spot when it comes to monetary policy?
No, that's a good thing that you mentioned that, because we also discussed that and highlighted in the paper. We say that it's true that interest rates are low, are expected to remain low, but it's true that this could be problematic for financial stability and for housing in particular, because it's true that it's easier to indebt yourself if interest rates are low. So it's true that the ECB will have to play a role. The ECB has to consider financial stability risk and not only price stability, because in the end, as you say, financial instability lead actually to price instability. So that's something that they need to take into account. However, we think that the main tools should not be used for this. We think that, the ECB's main mandate is price stability, so they should focus on that. And there should be other set of tools in order to deal with that issue. And we discuss, of course, macroprudential tools. We think they are very important. And the only problem is that maybe in Europe, the setup might not be the right one. But the ECB could play a role in that and help make it evolve in the next few years.
Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have today. We could continue, obviously, for another hour. It was a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much, Maria. Thank you so much, Gregory. It was a pleasure to discuss this topic with you.
Thank you.